This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 22nd of October 1955. The title of this lecture is The Road to Perfection, The Goodness of Man. This tape is 46 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
How are you today?
Fine.
Our difficulties in Dianetics and Scientology are many and manifest. But mostly, we are traveling too fast. In fact, we are traveling very fast. The speed of the age, I am told, is jet plane. Nothing which goes slower than jet could possibly hope to be considered modern. Well, we have done something we really didn't intend to do when we forwarded the speed of advance in the field of the human mind up to rocket ship, thereby bypassing jet plane. And if anything is wrong with Dianetics and Scientology, their speed of advance and development is just a little bit too fast for this jet plane age. Just a little too fast. In fact, some of the auditors, some of the practitioners in Dianetics and Scientology would tell you confidentially that we have an awful hard time keeping up. But actually, nothing that we have done or learned in these sciences is today being neglected. Nothing. And what we are doing is simply doing faster what we intended to do originally. That's all. Now I have here in my hand a group of tests, and these tests were taken by a very, very excellent psychometrist, one who studies this subject, who tests people to find out what their intelligence is, what their aptitude is, and what their various personality traits are. And this expert, in taking these tests, has mirrored here on paper exactly what is being done in processing today. And this is a factual representation, a graphic analysis done by people whose business it is to do such analyses of what Dianetics and Scientology can do today. And I just received this battery. It was placed in my hands from the males the moment I stepped on the stage at this moment. And what these tests tell me is that we have exceeded the jet plane age, because these tests, each one mirrors 25 hours of address to a case by an individual auditor, each one of them. And the bulk of these tests are uncoached. That is to say, the auditor didn't consult me or consult somebody else. He simply went ahead with the processes he knew and he did these tests. That is to say, he did this processing and accomplished these tests. Now, you see, this is called a temperament analysis profile. When we go into testing, we kind of get very, very close to bureaucracy. We try to make the pieces of paper do all the work and eliminate individual judgment of the work that is being done. In other words, none of the tests which we permit to be employed in testing results in Dianetics and Scientology are what they call subjective tests. They aren't a test where the fellow sits back and says, well, my personal opinion of this fellow is that it's so and so and so and so. No, these things must do something else. They must standardize to the extent that there is no human factor introduced in the interpretation. And this is such a test. This is a graph of what has happened in the life of one human being who was processed by a Scientology auditor. And it says here that this test was done before and after, and we find that this individual at the beginning was in the rather non-optimum state of being 52% nervous. He was nervous to that degree. And we find that at the end of processing, he had dropped to 42%. Now, here we have that this individual was 66% sympathetic, and he became 90% sympathetic. This is rather fabulous when you look that one over. That is an awful change of relationship with his fellow man. It means that he would walk down the street ordinarily, and he would see a little child sitting on the curb, and he would go by, and there's a little child sitting on the curb, you see. And at 90%, why, he would say, "Hiya, how you doing?" He'd probably answer him, too, you know. It means that in his human relationships, he would become somewhat understanding of human frailties, which before, I can assure you, he never was understanding about. They ought to know better than to have all those broken legs, you know? That's sort of an attitude. Now, we have here that the individual's objectivity increased. That simply means that he looked at the environment better. And that is a considerable change, but is not as good as we can do. It's a change of only 6% in objectivity, but that's still something that wasn't done before, but we just let something like that go. Now, here we have, however, that this individual, prior to processing, was one of these super salesman types, you know. You're going to buy that car or that package of biscuits, whether you like it or not. You're going to accede to his will in any other direction, whether you like it or not, you know. Wife says, "Dear, I don't feel well tonight." "That doesn't make any difference. We're going out to the club," you know, and they went. You know, a nice cooperative individual. And we discover that the individual changed to this degree. He dropped 40% in his aggressiveness, says right there. His aggressiveness dropped 40%. In other words, he now became somewhat able to cooperate. He said to people, "Oh, you don't want to buy this car? Well, we have some other cars, you know." Significant change. And probably the most interesting change here in this individual was a change of 22% in his self-mastery. In other words, before, he was walking down the street led by he didn't quite know what, and after a while, at the end of processing, he knew he was taking him down the street. Get the idea? That's just one test. But it's interesting that something happened in this series of ours which is completely impossible. We have been told by those who should have known better for almost a century, that the change in the intelligence or the ability to study or the ability to understand of an individual was impossible. That individuals of such and such an age have a certain ability to understand. And if an individual is a moron, he stays a moron. And if an individual is a genius, he remains a genius until he, of course, burns himself out. And that's the way it is, and that's all there is to it, and you'd better not fool around and change anybody's abilities or understandings in life. Because if you understood their abilities in life, you might get the idea of what we're up to, and we wouldn't like that. But nobody at any time ever believed that you could change intelligence, the ability to study, to grasp, to understand, to hear what's said, understand it, and not necessarily think that either. That has a lot to do with understanding. And we find that this individual, who, by the way, was, I noticed his name here and just happened to know this man, just happened to know him. I happen to know him because he's one of the most famous names in the oil business in the United States. And this character was getting along with an IQ of 118. And that's not really up to college average. Somehow or another, his oil empire was sufficiently easy to run, but with an IQ of 118, he could still run it. Of course, it was business. You don't have to be very intelligent in business, and you'd better not be very understanding. You might pay somebody some living wages. It's a great liability in business. We find that this IQ of 118 advanced during these hours of processing to 149, which is genius level. Now, why should we do this for this fellow? We'll do this for this fellow just for this reason. We find on this side he was better able to understand his fellow man. And an individual in this position in life has certainly an enormous potentiality for good or evil, doesn't he? His actions can reflect on an enormous number of people, not only just his employees, but everyone he's doing business with. And his understanding of man, his ability to say hello to the little kid, or to understand what an employee or another person is doing or saying or feeling, increased sufficiently here to make his intelligence in getting the job done worthwhile. It's quite interesting, isn't it? So you might say that this case was a public service. And actually, these changes here are wild, but they're all in the direction of an improvement of a human being. Isn't that odd? They're in the direction of an improvement of a human being. You know, it could be the reverse, but not in Scientology. And I myself can only explain why that is. It's not just the goal of Scientology. It's that if man is going to change, he must be changed for the better. If you're going to change a man, you must change him for the better. Ah, we're not interested in this enormous pack of tests. They go on like that. I didn't pick the two best ones and show them to you. This is something that is so simple that it is very hard to explain. Do you understand? It's so simple that it certainly never would have been grasped in a university. I've been in a university, and it was interesting, but not very educational. Now, oh, that isn't, there's anything wrong with universities. Universities are, they're nice. In America, a university is a football stadium which has some places to sit out between halves called classrooms. I had a description one time. A university is that set of buildings which are entirely surrounded by a stadium. Anyway, all due respect to the good chaps who work in them, because there are a lot of good guys. The fact of this change, it is a very interestingly simple fact. If anyone before had ever really tried to change man for the better, each and every man, not only somebody else's better, but his too, they probably would have arrived with that change. See? But always somebody was trying to suppress the individual in favor of the society, and some fellows are trying to suppress society for the benefit of the individual. A Hitlerian stunt. It doesn't work either. Englishmen come along and kill him off every time. Unpopular thing to do. Now, they just keep doing it, century after century. Huh? Next one that comes up over in Europe, I'm going to get his... Probably he won't be able to read anything of his own language. They seldom can. I'm going to get life of Napoleon and the life of Hitler and the life of about 15 more. Specially translated into his language and dedicate the translations to him and make sure that he reads them. he'll find out that the suppression of the multitude for the benefit of the individual is antipathetic at least to the Anglo-Saxon. Which I think is very interesting. Now, anyhow, every time anybody tried to effect a change in an individual, it was sort of like pushing down this part of him to raise this part of him, you see, or pushing down this part of him to raise that part of him, and they sort of maintained a status quo. They didn't change the individual. They just simply suppressed one thing to release another thing and so on. So it all added up more or less the same thing. But if anybody at any time, I thoroughly believe, whether in the field of religion or science or anything else, had simply said, now look, not only should society get a break, but the individual himself ought to get one. Not only should the state get a break, but the family should too. And let's see if we can't raise all these things simultaneously, they would have gotten the same changes there. Because man will change only in the direction of good on all fronts. If you change him on all fronts, he only changes in one direction, good. It's an oddity. Tells you there must be something wrong with the idea that man is evil. Well, I didn't come out here to play a violin on that subject today. But it's nevertheless quite interesting. It tells you something about your fellow man. He changes well and easily in the direction of good, and hardly changes at all in the direction of evil. You can take an evil man, and it's pretty hard to make him more evil. It's almost impossible. In fact, nobody's ever done it. If he had evil inclinations, he could be worked over one way or the other, some Jack the Ripper or somebody. He could be worked over by people, and he'd remain just about as evil as he was. No change. So evil intentions to one person or another, seems to be a sort of an unchanging thing. And where an organization or a science works uniformly in the direction that man is evil, doesn't change him. It's one of these horribly simple lessons. If we have an organization which believes that man is evil and is trying to change him for the benefit of the society or something of the sort, man doesn't change. The intention of the change plus the evil nature of the brute, that sort of thing, you know, fixes him on that level. It's just as easy as that. I mean, there he is. Now, there's man at that level of evil and revolt and unrest and laziness and stupidity and so forth. And all a society or an organization seems to do, according to all past psychometric testing, when it seeks, from the standpoint that he is evil, to keep him from doing more harm or something of that sort, all he seemed to do is take great big spikes and nail him right there at that point. And this is where psychology, psychiatry, phrenology, and other sciences got their idea, I suppose. Because they must have started out with the idea that they had to do something about man because he was so wicked that he was liable to hurt somebody else or something of that sort. I mean, they must have had a motive of this kind because they immediately assumed, and now I'm talking to you about a scientific fact we can demonstrate any day. They must have assumed that he was evil because they didn't change him. Now, it's an interesting thing. We didn't assume man was good. We didn't assume he was evil. We just decided to look at him. And we started to change him in any way, shape, or form that he could be changed. And we found out that he didn't just change in the direction of good. The second you start to change him from the good intent of giving him a hand, his family, society, man at large, as soon as you started to change him all the way along the line in the direction of good, as soon as you started to give him a pat on the back and help all hands in all directions, he didn't just change. It was like taking your hand off a compressed bedspring. It went spong. It's fantastic. Now, that's what we know about man today. It's a very simple thing. We know that a man can change toward good, but he doesn't change in the direction of evil. And we know that an evil intention does not change man, but fixes him, but that a good intention does. Now, we've seen all this scattered back through religions. We've had messiahs and so on come up time and time again and say something like this: love thy neighbor, turn the other cheek. The Buddhist idea of do unto your brother like you'd have him do unto you, and that sort of thing. But they couldn't have been a very clear expression of the situation, because man evidently didn't get this terribly simple lesson involved therein. Maybe they didn't know it. Maybe they did. Who cares? The point is that too many times the intention of such organizations as followed these messiahs was to hold man in check for the benefit of the church or the society or for some group. And this man had to be held in line. And the reason you had religion was to hold him in line and keep him from spilling over and doing evil and wicked things to his fellow man. Became used then as a control mechanism, didn't it? We've seen that time and time again, age after age. We have seen mankind disgracing himself with such things as autos da fe, British seamen being burned alive because they wouldn't say Hail Mary or something, probably couldn't talk Spanish, maybe nobody even asked them. We see all kinds of oddities occurring down through the years, the centuries. Here's a messiah. Well, I'm no messiah. I'm just a guy. But here's some real fellows like, Christ and Buddha, even Muhammad. They come along and they say, man, I should treat man nicely, and you ought to be good to your fellow man, and you ought to walk lightly where his spiritual nature is concerned. And they say these various things, and then they somehow or other, organizationally or some way or even in their own implication, they see that these control factors start to be leveled at the individual to keep him in line for the good and benefit of the rest of the society of the human race. Spanish Inquisition, something like this comes along. We're going to operate so that the world will be safe from those horrible British seamen that turn up every once in a while, you know, some foolish thing like this, and they start burning people. So the world will be safe from somebody who believes a little different than we do. See, they start to save the world and save mankind by ridding it here and there of evil elements. And whenever they try to rid it of evil elements, wow. Where's it go? What's it do? It might go down slightly, but actually it fixes at a low level. And then a fellow has an awful time trying to pull it up, even vaguely, organizationally, and without a philosophy to back him up. He has an awful time. I mean, such organizations, no matter what goodness they spring from, then have an evil intention. They have an opinion that man had better love his neighbor. And they try to change men, and they fail. Fabulous. The history of man is well understood by a study of psychometric testing, which tells us that man changes in the direction of good with ease. With such ease that it's unbelievable. We give him a break. We know that if we help him out, why, his society around him, his family, his friends, and so forth, they'll all be bettered because of this. We know that he won't suffer at all because of this. We simply raise his ability. We make him more able. We're not processing him in the first place because he's bad or evil or wicked and should have something horrible done to him. We just say, well, how are you, Joe? Glad you came along. Glad you'd like a little processing. We'll see if we can't fix you up so you can think faster or react quicker. Be happy to. We don't have any opinion of Joe. We don't say we're fixing him up because he's an evil man or because his family has got to be this and that. We usually fail when we do that. We have, of course, sinned in this direction a few times. We said if we don't get a hold of that joker and process him, Lord knows what will happen. But this was forgiven by the fact that when we got hold of him, we found out he was a human being with his own problems, and we helped him solve them. And so, we find all his efforts and directions and urges to survive were in the direction of being better and making things better. And they kept coming up, coming up. And that direction, up, there's no ceiling. Evidently, it's no top. Several of these tests have gone off the top of standard intelligence tests, which only pretend to measure a few of the geniuses of the world. We had a chap down here at Oxford one time. Got a fantastically high set of grades. So with this man and several others in the world, why, the people doing psychometric testing said, well, we'll top his grade by 1 or 2 points. And then of course, we've got the rest of the human race buttoned up, and anytime we give a test, it'll naturally be below this point because he's the brightest man the race ever produced. Auditor comes along whose own IQ, he could always stand some auditing. Always. His own IQ, maybe only about 130, something like that. He comes along and he starts processing this fellow, and so it starts going up. And brighter, brighter, smarter, smarter. Test the fellow again. He tests just right fine, right up here to the top of the IQ scale. Nobody put any numbers here. Where is it? He's gone off the top of the register. Well, a fellow with an IQ of 130 puts a fellow off the top of the register. What's it mean? It simply means the fellow processing him didn't think he had to hold a beast in chains for the benefit of humanity. It's because the fellow processing him didn't believe that a great control and regulation had to be exerted. Because the fellow doing the processing himself was not continually interjecting his own personal opinions upon the person who was undergoing Scientology processing. And so the fellow could go out the top. In other words, the human race can lift itself by its own bootstraps. But it's a huge joke, this one fact. It is a joke on all the Hitlers and the Napoleons and the little tin god police officers that have sat over the heads of dictatorial states and forged the chains of thought and law around the ankles of people. It's a joke on these men. They were trying to change their fellow men. This is obvious because of their own personal opinions, which are available. It's a huge joke. They should laugh in hell for an eternity over this joke. They only had one way they could do, and that was up. To better and better and smarter heights, to greater understanding, to greater and greater communication and belief and association in one's fellow man. That's the only direction they ever could have achieved any change. They could kill a man, but they had a hard time making him worse. You understand? All he had to do was give him a couple of swats on the back and a few hours of auditing, and they would have changed him out through the roof. A state has as its sole assets the natural wealth of the state, the willingness to work on the part of its people, and the brightness of its thinkers. And those are the assets of a state. And anybody that thinks it has more assets than that is going to go aground one way or the other and be beaten up on the surf. That's all the assets actually a state has. It's got its natural resources, willingness of its workers to work, and the brightness of its thinking men, the men who get ideas and do things. Now there is, in a nutshell, the wealth of a state. Somebody comes along and tells you, well, actually it's how many work units you can get somebody to work, you know, some ideology or other. It's how much you can steal from your satellite neighbors, how much you can buy out of the Central American public and ship into New York. They'll tell you all sorts of things. The amount of gold which it has in some fort. the amount of small change which is in the pockets of people. They say these things are wealth. These things are trash. All he could possibly do is measure the amount of natural resource, the willingness to work, and the thinking man's ability to think, put it into action. Now, if those three things are good, then money is good. If those three things are good, then the world repute of that nation is good. If those three things are good, then that nation doesn't get into very much trouble anymore. And if those three things are good, then the people are happy. You speak of wealth, that's wealth. Just like the average worker, wealth does not lie in how many pounds he has in his bank account or how many dollars he's bought war savings bonds with or something like that. This is all very well, very practical, all that sort of thing, but his actual wealth is his potentiality for getting work done. And of course, this means his potentiality for getting along with his fellow man. That's his wealth. He has 30 more years in which he can work, 30 more years in which he can earn, 30 more years in which he can associate with his fellows. It's interesting, isn't it? But that's his wealth. You could add to his wealth and say a little bit more about it in saying his wealth was in how many friends he had. His wealth was in how decent his country was. His wealth lay in how much he trusted or otherwise the ideas which his society could generate. That's real wealth. That's livingness. Anytime you can sew a man up in a bag of pound notes and have him live, I will buy the idea that money is wealth. But here's this state. And by one kind of chicanery or another, it seeks to coerce its neighboring nations. It seeks to coerce its laborers into producing this or that towards some unworthy goal. And its wealth is gone. Something happens to it economically. It tries to produce in the direction of some relatively unworthy goal, such as to make 15 men rich, or to make several emperors capable of plating a couple of palace floors with gold, being made to work in the direction of supporting more police officers, being made to work in the direction of paying more income tax, doing something, you see. Somebody's got goals like this. It doesn't thrive very well. Doesn't thrive at all. Has trouble. The next thing you know, everybody has to adjust this side of that and the balance sheets, and we've got this going over here and that going over there, and it's all getting too complicated. We have international misrelations, and wham. You see the difficulties? Because there's some other worthy intent in the use of this wealth. This wealth is only as good as is understood. Work is only as good as it's enjoyed, not as it's paid. Natural resources are only as good as they can be utilized, not thrown away. And thought is only as good as it can express the goals and desires of man himself. And those things become wealth. But the second, as I was talking to you earlier, you start to use any of these items to suppress or fix in place individuals in the society and segments of mankind, you merely inhibit their ability to get better. You really, in the long run, don't do a thing. It's a curious thing. Now, I haven't strayed off into economics. Economics is a very intimate thing to man. He often asks himself, what is wealth? He's rather astounded when you say, wealth? Well, wealth is the number of pounds, of course. It's the number of pounds that a printing press can turn over. Or is it? supposing the printing press were rolling like mad and all the money was all backed up by all the securities in the world, and you had a pound note, and you went down the street, you went into a store and you said, give me a loaf of bread, here's a pound note, and the fellow says, that won't buy bread here. Must be something else there. Supposing you had wheelbarrow load of the stuff. Supposing the printing presses run so fast that you'd gotten some terrific inflation. Of course, you'd go in with a wheelbarrow load of this stuff and you'd say, give me a loaf of bread, and he'll say, that won't buy anything here. Inflation. Well, let's look at deflation. Fellow goes down the street with a loaf of bread, saying to people, do you want this loaf of bread? We made it. Has anybody got any money with which to buy this loaf of bread? I need farthings and pence to buy the things I need, and therefore you will have to give me farthings and pence for this loaf of bread. Look, it's a loaf of bread, isn't it? It's edible. And the fellow could bake wheelbarrow loads of it, and he still wouldn't be able to give it to anybody if they had to buy it, because there's no money around. And that's all a depression is. That's all a deflation of currency is. It's just no money around. It's not enough money to buy the existing goods, real or personal property, afloat in the state. You see that? That's actually what it is. You can talk about the law of supply and demand and the law of reject and acceptance and the law of this and the law of that, but the truth of the matter is, as works out in actual practice, if you have too many goods and too little money to buy them, you have a depression. That's all. And if you have too much money and too little goods, you've got an inflation. If you've got an inflation, all you had to do is take a lot of that money out of the society in a hurry, and you've got a normal economic system. If you've got a depression, you'd better get money into that society in a hurry so that they can buy those goods. Economics are very difficult. But why are they difficult? If they are, they're only as difficult as they're utilized to bring about a state of servitude on the part of one's fellow man, to bring about a state of suppression and slavery, to depress and hold in chains a worker. And when economics are used to do that, believe me, they not only become complicated, they don't work. The end product of complication is unworkability. If you make anything complicated enough, it won't work at all. They had some aircraft engines they were building just before the war, which are the most gorgeous things you ever saw. There was gasoline went in here to heat them up, you see, and then there were cooling jets that went in there to cool them down. There were push rods which pushed something up so that something else could be pushed down to push this push rod to push them up. Gorgeous. They weighed like the dickens. They cost like the mischief. They didn't work. They made a lot of manufacturers a lot of money, though. Anyhow, every time you use economics for any other purpose than to accelerate or retard exchange of goods, real property and personal property, economics become untenable as a subject. And unworkable for a people. You see that? See the principle involved here. If we try to use any intention to suppress or hold down one's fellow in any direction, we've actually nailed him a little bit in place, but we haven't made him a bit better. And then, because we're part of our fellow man, we can't possibly advance past that point either. Economics. Just there's a stray subject. Could you take economics, though, and with a full, open-eyed, open-hearted intention, take the simplicity of this subject, which lies in just this fact that the individual citizen must have enough money to buy the goods which are for sale? That's the principle. He simply has to have enough money to buy the goods for sale, and there must be enough goods for sale for him to buy them. And these two things have to be held on a one-for-one ratio. For every dollar's worth of bread, you must have a dollar's worth of money. You see this? For every car, there must be enough hundreds of pounds of money to buy it. When you don't have that money there, you've got a car, but it can't transfer hands. It can't circulate. It can't communicate. And if we have too much money over here and too few cars here, once more, somebody's going to grab a hold of that car. They're going to put a blanket over it. They're going to hide it. They're going to say, "Who's a car? You're not going to ride my car. It's the only car in this whole borough." See how an unbalanced system can result from this? Well, when these economic principles are employed for the purposes of good, there's only one direction of change possible, and that's up. It's a hideous fact that change is possible upward. Change is possible into greater wealth, greater prosperity. But you start to fix one of these downward spirals by suppression, slavery, duress, and it fixes right there. It doesn't alter. It doesn't come up any. It doesn't get any better. If you just try to knock out those dogs that are making this horrible depression exist, it'll stay a depression. You see the idea? Another thing the society does on this same principle, which is quite interesting, is men are always around telling the worker that he should have shorter hours and more pay. Shorter hours and more pay. And this is the song they sing. And it's a rather stupid song, because that is the goal of a slave. A free man wants more work and more communication. It's an oddity. Free man wants to see how much he can get done. A free man wants to see how much he can accomplish and how well he can do it. He's interested. He's alert. He's the master of the work. And when we get this shorter hours and more pay, the work becomes the master of the man, because he's seeking to avoid it. Man's no longer mastering this work. And so, with enough strikes, you, of course, eventually get great oddity occurs. You get a depression, or you get an inflation. Either one. But you certainly get an imbalance of the economic system, because one of the factors of real wealth is being neglected, the willingness of the worker to work, and somebody's in there trying to depress it all the time, trying to depress it, trying to tell him that it's no fun to run these blast furnaces, it's no fun to run these trains. You should fall back and say, we have to be awarded for this arduous activity. When I was a young writer, rather, New York City, I used to have the idea that the most horrible thing that anybody could ever be asked to do would be to run one of those subway trains in New York. Zoom, and go up one end of the world. Zoom, and go down to the other. As far as New York is concerned, New York is the world. And that's right. London is just in its suburbs. It has awfully big ideas. The only one town has any bigger ideas. That's Los Angeles. And it believes it's lost New York somewhere in its city limits. The only one bigger idea in the United States, that's Texas. Texas is three times as big as the United States. We finally found out how big it is. So, they keep telling these men that they must fall back. And I was thinking that men should fall back from such an arduous pursuit as running a subway train up and down and up and up. I thought the fellow would go mad. So one day I decided to write a story about a subway. It was going to be a terrible tragedy. It was the fellow who had been put into the chains of running one of these subway trains in the dark most of the time and so forth. So I went down, having maybe a little more sense than some of my more romantically minded fellows. I didn't just sit down like some labor reporter and write the story, you know. I thought I'd better go find one of these boys and talk to him. And I did. And about an hour later, he had me standing at the controls of a subway train having an awful good time running it down through these tunnels. And I learned something right there and then. The willingness to work. And that man wasn't a slave. But the fellow who kept telling him to strike, strike, strike. That man was. And that man was trying to make slaves. And so that man never improved labor. That man never improved the community in which he existed. But the fellow over here who was simply telling me, now, you handle the controls this way and you send the train down that way and this is a lot of fun. Believe me, the world was better for that guy having lived. And furthermore, horribly enough, I hate to say this, I hate to say that we've actually removed this whole subject out of the field of speculation. You can make man better, but fortunately you can't make him worse. But if you try to make him worse in order to make him better, you always fail. If you just relax about the whole thing and credit your fellow man with a willingness to do these various things, a great oddity occurs. You inevitably make him better. Fortunately, man only changes in the direction of the zenith. He only changes in the direction of the stars, and he never changes in the direction of the snake pits. Maybe he's just cussed enough to know this basically down deep somewhere. Maybe he's just ornery enough to feel that he's gone far enough south at any time he's gone south at all. And maybe the only direction he's left open is the stars. Thank you.